Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
National Car Rental has your back, road warriors, because we know you're picking up the pace, steering life at 10 and 2. You're hitting the road, and National's helping you get there with the confidence of our complete clean pledge. So skip the counter without missing a beat and choose any car in the aisle. National Car Rental. Go like a pro. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Mars, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 12th of April, these are our main stories. President Biden has arrived in Northern Ireland for a visit marking 25 years since the Good Friday peace deal ended decades of violence. Russia has tightened the rules for drafting new recruits for the war in Ukraine, making it technically impossible to dodge the draft. The IMF says most economies will avoid going into recession this year, and there'll be modest global growth for 2024. Also in this podcast.
Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun. Since Tupperware.
But its share price has sprung a massive leak. Can it survive? President Biden is in Northern Ireland to mark the 25th anniversary of the agreement that ended the decades-long conflict there. Before leaving Washington, Mr. Biden was asked the purpose of his trip.
Make sure the Irish Accords and the Windsor Agreement stay in place. Keep the peace. That's the main thing.
Mr. Biden arrived on board Air Force One at Belfast International Airport on Tuesday evening and was welcomed by the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. He and the US leader smiled and shook hands and could be seen exchanging remarks on the tarmac after the president descended the stairs from the plane. Spotlights were set up around Air Force One, highlighting it, including the American flag on its tail wing. Northern Ireland is still plagued by political instability, despite the Good Friday Agreement. The local governing executive isn't working at the moment in Stormont at all. Bertie Ahern was the Irish Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, at the time of the signing of the agreement. What are his thoughts as Mr. Biden is in Northern Ireland?
Belfast is a lot of promise and a good future. And I think what the American president can say is that he can put his weight behind further economic investment. Northern Ireland is still divided. There's still peace walls. A lot of the issues around legacy. There still is segregated education. So there's still many difficulties. I honestly believe the best way of dealing with those issues, and I would have hoped this down the years, is for the politicians who are elected, who have a mandate to deal with these issues, and, should be working and meeting and dealing with them. And they should be doing that with the help of the Irish government, where they ask for it on north-south bodies, exchanging information and exchanging cooperation with the British government, where they need that, and with the European Union, where they need that, and with the help of America. So, this is what politicians should be doing.
The BBC's Charlotte Gallagher is in Belfast and outlines Mr. Biden's agenda on Wednesday in the city.
He's only actually spending less than 24 hours in Belfast itself and in Northern Ireland. He's going to a local university and he's going to be meeting students and staff, and he's going to be talking about the future of Northern Ireland with them, what they want their home to be like. He's also going to be meeting the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and high on the agenda with him will be the political instability we have here in Belfast, where the devolved government just isn't functioning at the moment. He will also briefly meet the leaders of the five main political political parties here. And that's kind of it for his time in Northern Ireland. He's then going to hop over the border to the Republic of Ireland. He's going to go to County Louth and County Mayo, where he has ancestral roots, and Dublin as well. He's spending a lot more time in the Irish Republic. I mean, here he was invited to speak at the home of the devolved government, but he turned it down, presumably because that building is now mothballed, essentially, because politics isn't functioning here.
One of Northern Ireland's biggest police operations in years has been put in place for the duration of Mr. Biden's visit. The BBC's Chris Page explains.
Cordons are up, roadblocks are there. There are dozens of police officers on the ground, armoured security vehicles there too. So these sorts of security operations have, of course, been seen before in Northern Ireland. This is the seventh US presidential visit, the first one by Bill Clinton in 1995. So people, particularly in the capital, Belfast, not unused to seeing these sorts of massive security operations swing into force from time to time. The roads that he's travelling on will have to be empty whenever he is making his journey. So motorists have been advised. Bill Clinton came here three times in the 1990s. George Bush came twice in 2003 and 2007. Barack Obama once in 2013. So this is the first US presidential visit in 10 years.
Chris Page in Belfast. It's said that someone once described Joe Biden as Irish as a pint of Guinness. Rajini Vaidyanathan asked Lynn Kelleher, an Irish journalist and author of The Green and White House, about Mr. Biden's personal ties to Ireland.
He's said to be 5/8 Irish, so, you know, fully Irish on his mother's side, and then there's one quarter of his father's side. That's actually a Galway relation. And then on his mother's side, the relatives are in Mayo and in County Louth. So, but he was, you know, he was brought up in Scranton in Pennsylvania, and it's as Irish a neighbourhood as you would guess. His neighbours were kind of 90% Irish. His grandmother used to speak Irish to him. She used to always say to him, Joey, that apparently he often was quoted as saying, Joey, the best drop of blood in you is Irish. So he would have, you know, Irish Catholic Democrat was nearly a conjoined word in that neighbourhood. And he would have grown up there, you know, steeped in Irishness, and has visited Ireland many times, you know, as a young man, you know, half a dozen times, he said in an interview in the 80s. And then there was the time he came as vice president. So it's very personal to him. It's very much how he identifies. He is hugely into Irish culture. He's into Irish history. He is often, you know, he's been seen to quote Irish poets as far away as Mumbai and China in speeches. So it's a very genuine personal connection for him.
It's personal. How does that translate to political gains?
He is here to mark the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And that was a huge thing for another Democratic president, Clinton. So it's to mark that. And then this is a trip, you know, that he spoke about even back in the 80s when he was asked, would he ever run for president? Would he come to Ireland? And he said, just try and stop me. You know, so this is, you know, he also came when he was vice president. And as you say, that 1 in 10 Americans would identify as Irish American, over 30 million. They're bipartisan, so they're Democratic, and then which they started off in as mainly Democratic, but then they moved, as they went upwardly mobile, the Irish Americans, they moved to Republican Party. So it's across the board. Yeah, there's a very strong Irish identity in America.
That was Lynn Kelleher, Irish journalist and author of The Green and White House. Since Russia invaded Ukraine last February, thousands of its troops have been killed or wounded. Moscow has tried to make up for those losses by using convicts, and in September, it started calling up hundreds of thousands of reservists to fight. Many people try to avoid the call-up by hiding or travelling abroad. Well, now Russia is set to move military call-up notices online, and that will make it far harder for young men to avoid conscription for the war in Ukraine. The BBC's Katerina Hinkulova told me more.
It is going to make it very difficult, because from now on, whenever a person is served military call-up papers, it goes onto this state database. It's called State Services, and it's a sort of website where Russians do literally everything. They apply for a new passport, they pay their gas bill, they can even make a GP appointment there. So it's once a person is there in the list of someone with a call-up paper, they have to go to their local conscription office, and they just can't avoid it. And the additional changes to the legislation is should they try and avoid it, should they not turn up at their local conscription office, then they face all sorts of restrictions. And that includes their driving license becoming invalidated. They can't buy or sell property. So, for example, that's going to directly affect the Russians who already, the men who already fled and who still have, you know, property, houses, flats in Russia.
And you mentioned people already having fled back in September. It's going to be harder now for people to get out of the country, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the first thing really is that people will automatically be banned from leaving the country. So this is it. This is sort of this dreaded closure of the borders. This is how it's going to happen. So in Russia, people were talking about that, you know, men will be stopped at borders. They won't be all stopped at borders, only those who are on the database. But that means that the individuals will be picked out and unless, you know, millions will start leaving now. But it is sort of anticipated that in the next few days, perhaps, there will be a new wave of men trying to flee. And as we know, of course, back in the autumn, thousands, perhaps as many as tens of thousands of Russian men have fled to neighbouring countries.
And in the past, these conscripts, who are often not well trained at all, are sent to the front line. So it is a pretty bad fate for them.
Absolutely. They're not well trained. They're not well equipped. We know from lots and lots of first-hand testimonies and stories, which are really dreadful, about people having to buy their own kit, the receiving no training at all, in many cases not wanting to go to the front line, becoming this sort of cannon fodder and sent to the front line. For those who do refuse to be called up, they're prosecuted and their fate is equally grim. So they survive, but they're likely to go to prison.
And the timing of this on the part of Moscow is not surprising, is it? Because they need more troops, particularly now because we're expecting some kind of offensive.
Yes, because of this supposedly planned Ukrainian spring offensive, but also because of just the sheer numbers that must have died or reported to have died in the past few months in that really bloody battle for Bakhmut alone that must have, you know, cost lots and lots of thousands of deaths for the Russian side.
That was Katerina Hinkulova. Britain's Defence Ministry has issued a response after a huge leak of alleged classified US military information suggested that the UK and other special forces had been operating in Ukraine. Without directly addressing the specific claims, the MOD described reports of the leak as demonstrating a serious level of inaccuracy with the potential to spread disinformation. The presence of Western special forces in Ukraine has been the subject of speculation for over a year, but has never been confirmed. It's likely to be seized upon by Moscow, which has in recent months argued that it is not just confronting Ukraine, but NATO as well. The Pentagon has described the leak of the documents as real and a serious risk to national security. Evan Davis spoke to Eric Toller, a researcher for the investigative open source intelligence group Bellingcat. So what is his theory on how these documents were leaked?
The origin is a lot dumber and more mundane than what most people are speculating, because most people think like, oh, it's some giant hack and dump, or oh, it's a Russian operation or Chinese this, or like a Snowden whistleblower. But from what I understand and talking to some people who claim they know the original leaker, it's just a guy who was trying to share documents with his friends in a small Discord server. So Discord, for those who don't know, who are maybe over the age of 25 and age of 30 who don't know, is a popular platform for mostly for people who play video games who can do like voice chat. It's kind of like a Slack or Microsoft Teams, but for like teenagers and young people who play video games mostly. And he was just sharing these with his friends, and they just happened to get leaked out to larger sources of them over time.
Sorry, but how did he get them?
He, as far as I understand, he is he works some job where he'd had access to these things.
Now, is his identity known at this point, Eric? Is he in trouble for this, or is that still the next mystery to be solved as to who he is?
Yeah, I don't know who he is. I've talked to people who claim to know who he is, who were on this tiny Discord server of, you know, a couple dozen active users. But yeah, I don't know who he is. If someone's listening and wants to call me up, so please don't harass me. I don't know who he is. The FBI, please don't. I'm sure it'll be discovered because the digital footprints left behind, especially if you can, you know, look at server logs, you know, if the FBI puts in or NSA or whatever puts in requests, it won't be too terribly hard to figure out.
You're suggesting in a way, Eric, this looks more like accident or potentially recklessness than a malicious leak. But how do you distinguish between an accidental leak and a malicious one?
Well, I mean, look at the intent by the people who were in the original server where this is getting leaked to. I've talked to a handful of people who were there. And what they describe is the guy was, you know, his friends are, you know, some teenagers mostly. He plays Call of Duty and Halo and whatever with. And he was posting these into a channel of this tiny Discord. And he didn't have any, you know, ideological or political motive. And he didn't mean for this to go to a bigger audience because he's been posting these for months and months and months back to, you know, to last year, even to the end of last year. And he would post these for his friends just to kind of, you know, keep them updated about the war and other going on in the world, kind of just kind of flex and show off, as I understand. He wasn't, you know, trying to become the next Edward Snowden, right?
Well, what's extraordinary about this is how long it took for anyone else to catch on that they were all sitting there, available for public view.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean, there's two different spans that are both baffling in their own way, right? So these documents have been posted for months and months, starting from last year on the tiny Discord channel, and no one noticed them except for people who were in this tiny Discord channel. And from there, it got posted into a couple of other larger Discord channels. Some have thousands of members of March and last year. Over 100 of these documents sitting in these servers, and they just sat there. No one noticed them for a month. I assume no one thought they were real because, you know, how could you imagine these, you know, sensitive top secret documents sitting in a Minecraft Discord server or something like that, or over a popular YouTuber?
Just to be clear, though, you don't think the story you've been given here is a false trail, that this is a whole constructed narrative covering up something a little darker?
I don't think so. I've talked to a handful of people involved in this. Yeah. I mean, from what I understand, I haven't seen any traces of this being some big malicious thing. It's bizarre.
Arik Toller from the investigative open source intelligence group Bellingcat. President Macron of France has been heckled at the start of a keynote speech on Europe's future during his state visit to the Netherlands. Demonstrators interrupted the president shortly after he took to the stage, shouting, "Where is French democracy?" in an apparent protest against Mr. Macron's government forcing pension reform plans through Parliament.
You delivered such strong messages, not just for Europe, but for humanity and our common values. Hello.
I think we lost something. Where is French democracy?
Where did we lose it?
Where did we lose it?
I can answer this question if you give me some time.
Well, Mr. Macron replied calmly that democracy was exactly what allowed the protesters to make their voices heard. The French president also called on European countries to actively support their industries and be less reliant on production elsewhere. And he warned that Europe would not be sovereign unless it protected its own economic power. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, was listening.
President Macron says Europe needs to develop an industrial policy. Governments need to intervene to boost production of strategically essential goods, things like microchips, defense equipment, and particularly green technology. He says the Chinese and the US government are doing this. Europe's going to be left behind if it just leaves everything to the free market. He said, how would we feel if we got to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but we only could do it with Chinese kit? President also said we need a bit of protection. He bemoaned the way European countries have sold off their assets to the highest bidder. This, he says, needs to stop.
Paul Moss. Still to come, Yaya returns home to China from the US. Is it the beginning of the end of panda diplomacy? We'll be right back after this.
The Comb is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out stories and voices from across Africa that might otherwise go unheard.
It was a moment that was filled with hope.
It was emotional.
I had to sit down and put myself in other people's shoes.
Catch up with the whole series now by searching for The Comb.
This is The Comb.
The Comb.
The Comb.
Wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Comb.
Welcome back. As we heard in the earlier podcast, a military airstrike on a village in Myanmar is thought to have killed at least 50 people, including children. The Burmese armed forces appear to have targeted the village in the region of Siang because it contains opponents to its coup. If confirmed, it would be one of the deadliest incidents in Myanmar's civil conflict. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head is monitoring the situation from Bangkok.
Please call out if you're still alive. We're coming to help you, shout these men, as they walk through scenes of appalling carnage in the village of Paziji. In the background, wooden buildings burn or smoulder. They try to count the bodies, but many are in pieces, One villager told the BBC that a military jet had flown over it around 7 in the morning and dropped a bomb, followed by a helicopter gunship, which strafed the village for 20 minutes. Pazigi had been unusually crowded, with people from nearby communities attending a ceremony to mark the opening of a new local administration office, loyal to the opposition, not to the military government. That is almost certainly why it was attacked. Frustrated by the failure of its troops to regain control of much of the country, the junta has increasingly been relying on its Russian and Chinese aircraft to bomb opposition villages, causing much higher civilian casualties. If the death toll at Pazigi is confirmed, this may be one of the most deadly single incidents so far in the Myanmar civil war.
Meanwhile, the BBC has been reconnecting with people inside Myanmar, who we'd spoken to at the time of the military coup, to hear more about how their lives have changed over the past 2 years. It is very hard to contact people in the country, and many are unwilling to speak because of safety fears. But one person sent the BBC an audio message. These people wanted to remain anonymous.
It has been 2 years since military coup, and Myanmar people are still trying to get democracy back. Our lives have become worse and worse. The value of Myanmar jet against the dollar dropped. Commodity prices rose sharply. Gold and gasoline prices skyrocketed. Many people lost their jobs, and we face with more electricity outages in Myanmar.
I'm a doctor, and I was working in a non-governmental organization since 2019, and our project stopped because of military coup. It's really difficult to get a job in these days, and I'm now jobless because many NGO projects had to stop since coup. Before coup, we can go everywhere, and no matter how late it is, it's always safe to hang out with friends. But after coup, we have to go home early as the soldiers and police are checking the people and cars, and sometimes they shoot with their guns. And because of the increased commodity prices, robberies and assault rates have increased. Our lives are not safe even in big cities, and we all are still resisting by our own forces and still hoping for international help to restore our democracy back. We won't give up.
Some voice messages there from people living in Myanmar. The UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, who's begun a visit to Somalia, has called for massive international support. The UN has launched a multi-billion dollar appeal for the country, where millions are facing famine. So far, it's received little funding. Mr. Guterres said people were suffering and the need was urgent.
Although Somalia makes virtually no contribution to climate change, the Somalis are among the greatest victims. Nearly 5 million people are experiencing high levels of acute food insecurity. And of course, rising prices make matters worse. So I call on donors and I call on the international community to step up their support.
Ferdinand Omondi has more on Mr. Guterres' comments.
In a joint press address with Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, the UN Secretary-General said the 5 consecutive years of drought was the country's worst in recorded history. He said the country had only received a fraction of the assistance needed to prevent malnutrition and displacement, save lives and avert famine. Mr. Guterres also sought more support for Somalia in the fight against Al-Shabaab, saying the country deserved solidarity for its resilience.
Ferdinand Omondi. The International Monetary Fund says most economies will avoid going into recession this year, but global growth will be slightly lower than last year. The IMF said the situation should change in 2024. It also says it expects the UK to be the worst performer of any major world economy this year. Our economics editor, Faisal Islam, reports.
The IMF has reiterated its forecast for this year that the UK economy is experiencing a mild downturn, placing it bottom of the pile of the G7 group of major economies, which it topped last year during the pandemic rebound. The IMF's forecasts also show the UK to be the slowest growing of the wider G20 group of countries, including India, China, and sanctions-hit Russia. While expectations of a recession have receded, the UK economy, alongside Germany, is expected to shrink as the effect of high prices, interest rate rises and energy costs continue. The world economy is forecast to grow 2.8% in 2023, but the IMF's chief economist, Pierre-Olivier Gourinchas, said recent financial problems, including the failure of a number of US banks and the near collapse of Credit Suisse, could weigh on the global recovery.
The recent banking instability reminds us that the situation remains fragile. Once again, downside risks dominate. Inflation is much stickier than anticipated, even a few months ago. While global inflation has declined, this reflects mostly the sharp reversal in energy and food prices. But core inflation, excluding energy and food prices, has still not peaked in many countries.
But the IMF also argues that once the current inflation shock is over, normal interest rates in advanced countries could fall to around 2% as the result of wider global economic trends. That might offer some respite to those homeowners currently facing significant rises in mortgage costs, though this may take some years to materialise.
Faisal Islam. Giant pandas, large, fluffy and photogenic, have been the face of conservation movements for decades, but they also have huge diplomatic powers. For years, China has sent them on loan to other countries across the world. But the 20-year visit of Yaya at Memphis Zoo in the US has now come to an end. Many people had become concerned about her health. Her male mate, Lele, died in February, and Yaya has been pictured with her fur looking rather mottled, thin and patchy. Memphis Zoo says she was well looked after, but many in China disagree. Our China social media analyst is Carrie Allen, and she told me more about the hoo-ha over Yaya.
This is a story that's been very, very closely covered in China, and now her 20-year lease has come to an end. Huge send-off at Memphis Zoo with cake for the panda, and a lot of excitement for Chinese audiences that she's finally going to be coming back to China.
And this marks an end to yet another example of panda diplomacy, pandas being used to, I suppose, to bring countries together. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Panda diplomacy is a big thing in China. You'll often actually see on Chinese news websites whole sections, you know, like you get politics, society. You'll sometimes see sections just on pandas. They really are a form of soft power in terms of the relationship between two countries. So I think it's very notable that this is a panda in the US. Two pandas, if you include Lila as well, Yaya and Lila. But a lot of messaging in state media that the US might not be properly looking after its pandas. And as we know, the US and China have very fraught relations as it is anyway. Also, just in general, you will sometimes see very positive stories on the pandas at Moscow Zoo, and Russia and China have very close relations. So yes, a lot of people have been interpreting this as yet another failing in terms of relations between China and the US.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And do you think ordinary people who've been following this share that view, or is it just in the political newspapers and online magazines?
They very much do share this view. And in fact, one of the things that happened off the back of these pictures of Yaya circulating, not looking very well, is that overseas Chinese in other parts of the US and also other countries as well, in the UK, they went to zoos and started sending videos and images of pandas there to show audiences in China how they were being treated and whether they were well. That there is a feeling that it's part of their national identity to show that pandas, as a representation of China, are being looked after when they leave China and go to other countries.
That was our China social media analyst, Kerry Allen. Its food storage containers have been a familiar sight in kitchens for decades. But now Tupperware is warning that it could go out of business unless it can secure more funding. The 77-year-old American company's share price dropped nearly 50% on Monday, and it's struggling to attract younger consumers. Our business correspondent, Theo Leggett, lifts the lid on the story.
Now let's go to a little town in New Jersey where things are really popping. Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun.
Have a party, meet your friends, and sell some airtight plastic pots. It might not be the most inspiring approach by today's standards, but in the suburbs of the post-war United States, this kind of direct marketing was as popular as apple pie.
Since Tupperware can't spill or leak,
You can store it any which way in your freezer or refrigerator.
Pioneered by a single mother from Detroit, Brownie Wise, the Tupperware Party enabled women to make money by selling kitchen products to other women. Over the following decades, the technique helped turn Tupperware into a global phenomenon.
Come to a Tupperware party and see all the new ways you can lock in freshness.
Beans, greens!
But in more recent years, the brand has come to seem rather stale, despite attempts to freshen it up with innovative new products, such as a microwave grill. At the same time, the company's been struggling to cope with mounting debts and falling sales. Last week, it warned that its future was in doubt. There are real fears that without significant new investment, Tupperware's party may soon be over for good.
Jams keep jammier, hams keep hammier, cakes keep cakier, flakes keep flakier. Tupperware freshness, that's our promise. Look at all the ways we keep it.
That report was by our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
One of the most dangerous and prolific criminal hacking gangs in the world.
They're accused of robbing banks, stealing secrets, and causing mayhem everywhere, from hospitals to Hollywood.
Investigators say they're working on the orders of the North Korean state.
A claim dismissed by the regime as an attempt to tarnish the country's image.
A sovereign nation trying to earn revenue to fund weapons of mass destruction.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
In season 2 of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service,
we're picking up from where season 1 left off.
Far from disappearing into the shadows, it seems the Lazarus Group has been busy.
We have tracked your funds to a North Korean account.
Carrying out ever more elaborate money grabs.
Coordinating in more than 20 countries.
And they're not working alone.
He organized money laundering operations.
They found over $100,000 cash under his mattress.
Search for The Lazarus Heist wherever you get your BBC podcasts.